I'm Greg Johnson.
And I'm John Morgan.
I'm Michael Polignano.
Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. Today's guest is Tito Perdue. One of the great perks of running a publishing company is that you can read the works of your favorite authors, if you actually publish them, right? You can read the works of your favorite authors before anybody else does. And one of the distinct pleasures I've had this year is editing Tito Perdue's new novel, Sinusura. And he's going to talk to us about that novel, and he's going to talk to us about his life and work in general. So, Tito, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Can I ask you a quick question? How did you come to have the name Tito? Because your actual given name is Albert, right?
Yes. Well, I was born in Chile. My father was an electrical engineer employed in Chile as a electrical engineer for a copper company. And I was born there, and I was named after my father, Albert. But in Chile, the word Tito means little. It also can mean junior. So I was called Albertito, you know, Albert Junior, little Albert. And after a while, they dropped the Albert and people began calling me Tito. And it sounds so much more literary, you know, than merely Albert. So I decided to use that for my pen name.
That's really interesting. Of course, it calls to mind some great Romans, too, some Tituses and so forth. So,
Yes.
How many years did you live in Chile, Tito, before you came back to the South?
So I was born in Chile in 1938 and lived there for about 3 years. And then when the war broke out, my father was anxious to get back to the United States. And so we sailed back. We sailed from Valparaiso, Chile, to New Orleans in 1941 or 42. And what's interesting about that voyage was that the sea captain asked the passengers on board the ship. The ship was the Normandy, very famous ship, as you may know, that later on was sunk in New York Harbor, some think by German sabotage. Anyway, it was the greatest luxury liner of the time. And the passengers on the ship through the Caribbean were asked to stand at the railing to look out for German submarines. There was a real possibility that German submarines might attack passenger ships. And so my father can recall standing at the rail, you know, scanning out over the water, looking for periscopes. But of course, nothing like that ever appeared. So we got back to New Orleans, 1942 or 3, and my father found a job in Alabama, which was the place where he was born. So I lived thereafter for many years in a small town in northeastern Alabama. The best years of my life, by the way.
When did you decide that you wanted to become a writer?
I had the great good fortune to be sent to a private school. The public school in my little hometown was not very good. I wasn't learning very much, and I was beginning to fall in with some mischievous boys, which alarmed my parents. So they shipped me off to a private school in south of Birmingham, Alabama. It was the first year that school opened, so I was very lucky to get into it. And that was a good school. I mean, they really made us study, and we had to read and read deeply. You know, by the time I was 15 years old, I was reading Kant and Hegel and Nietzsche and all the others. And, you know, and you either had to study or you'd be expelled. So I studied and actually came to like it. And I became interested in literature, especially American literature. And I read Faulkner and Steinbeck and all the others. And then I fell absolutely in love with Thomas Wolfe. You know, Thomas Wolfe is a terrific writer for young people. And I was young, and I just adored his writing. And as a matter of fact, later on, when I was a senior in school, I went up to Asheville, North Carolina, in order to interview his surviving relatives. And I wrote my graduating term paper on Thomas Wolfe. That's how I really became interested in literature. I had decided pretty young that I either wanted to be a publisher or a literature professor or a bookseller, something to do with books. But I never really imagined that I myself could be a writer. So I surprised myself.
Your story reminds me a little bit of the story in Morning Crafts of the sort of country kid who's abducted and taken to this school where they just cram him full of Western civilization.
That's right.
He doesn't know if he likes it, but then he does after a while.
That's right. That's exactly what happened to me. You know, I was yanked out of my milieu, taken away from all my friends, everything that was familiar to me, and I was very reluctant to go. But I had a choice. I didn't have to go. So I thought about it long and hard and finally decided that I did want to go. And I was very small for my age, and I suddenly found myself taken away from home and thrown into this strange bunch of human beings who had been brought together at this private school. And I had to cope, you know. I had to learn how to live on my own. I was only 14 years old, but I had to deal with what I was faced with. And at first, I was nervous, you know. I mean, I was intimidated by my surroundings. But gradually, you know, I had never thought that learning could be fun. I thought it was an ordeal, something you had to do. And I can almost remember the very day I suddenly decided that it was fun, and it was the best fun there is. And since that day, I've become the sort of a fanatic that I am.
I find it interesting that you said that the private school you went to was, it sounds like it was much more challenging than the public school you were enrolled in at the time. Of course, then, this is before desegregation occurred, so I wonder what the quality of education was like in the public school that you were at.
It wasn't so bad. The public school was not terribly good, but at least, you know, it was disciplined and the students behaved fairly well. And I enjoyed it. I had a lot of friends. And, you know, when I went to private school, I lost contact with girls, for example. I missed that. And I enjoyed, you know, I enjoyed being among girls when I was in public school. One of the ordeals of private school for me, you know, was suddenly being wrenched out of my social circle and going months without even seeing a girl. You know, that's all the boys suffered from that. But it was worth it. And although the public school I went to was not horrible, still it wasn't very challenging. Now, of course, that same public school has been integrated, and it is absolutely worthless. The grounds are littered with prophylactics and hypodermic needles. The black students have an average IQ of about 75. Rape is common. The black girls, half of them, are pregnant. You know, the school now is a toxic zone, and any white mother or father that sends his child to an integrated school in the South ought to be put in prison for child abuse, because those schools now, after integration, are hopeless.
Yeah, that's so sad. That's so sad. I had a public school education. It was a homogeneous white town that I grew up in.
Yes.
And I had a pretty good education as an undergraduate. And yes. You know, it exposed me to all the right stuff. They didn't have a lot of language classes and things like that. But other than that, it was pretty standard and rigorous, and everything has declined. And it's declined not just because of integration, but also just because of political correctness. And
absolutely.
You could live in a 100% white relict population town in some place like North Dakota, and if you're a fifth grader, you get to write essays on J-Lo or something, just to expose you to something Latino or Latina or Latinx, whatever.
Right.
Even the homogeneous schools now don't teach very much compared to what they did in the past. There's been sort of a depressive effect of political correctness across the board in the country.
Oh, yeah. And the America's international rankings in education are very low, mm-hmm. well below other countries like Finland, for example. And I can recall when I was in high school, I remember the day that Hemingway won the Nobel Prize for Literature back in 52, I think it was. And the kids were kind of, they knew who he was, you know. They were a little bit excited, and people read books. Today, high school students haven't the slightest idea about modern American writers, you know, what's that fellow that writes the horror stuff?
Stephen King.
Yeah, that's the sort of material they read today. So, I was talking to a kid the other day, a high school student, and I mentioned some movies that I had seen that I used to like a lot. Marlon Brando movies, you know, for example. He'd never heard of Marlon Brando. He'd never heard of William Faulkner, you know. They are culturally cut off. They're culturally aborted. They come into the world believing that the world began the day they were born. They have no interest in the past. They consider it irrelevant. But I'm very pessimistic about the future of American education. You know, you could ask a high school student to name 500 rock groups. They can name not only the groups, they can name the biographical information of all the members. But they don't know when the Civil War took place. They don't know who came first, whether Alexander the Great came before Abraham Lincoln or the other way around. They know nothing. They're ignorant beyond belief. So that's why people like me, you know, feel like we're working in a vacuum. There's nobody out there. When I was young, I used to read writers, you know, and I used to go to concerts and good movies. And today, the kids consider all of that just beyond the pale. I can't understand why anybody would read a book unless the professor assigned it to them and made it necessary so that they can make a good grade, so they can get their diploma, so they can go out into the world and make as much money as possible. I mean, the society is so philistine, so crass, so degraded, that either there's going to have to be a social revolution pretty soon, or else this country is just going to crumble.
So how old were you when you wrote your first story?
Well, I had been writing stories when I was very young, but of course they were not any good, you know. They were a juvenilia of no value. And I wrote a couple of things in high school that were pretty much worthless.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't until I was almost middle-aged that I began seriously to write. I was working full-time and just simply didn't have the mental energy to do any serious writing till finally I forced myself to. And so my first writing when I was like 32 years old, 33, 34 years old, it was pretty bad, you know, pretty awful stuff. But I kept at it and finally churned out that first novel and then rewrote it three or four times. It was like 800 pages the first time and had to go back and weed it. And I made it satisfactory, I think. Finally got it published by this little left-wing publishing outfit in New York. I think they thought I was a left-winger, you know. And so they published it.
And that was the sweet... Was that the sweet-scented manuscript?
Yeah. Right.
I love that book, by the way. I really, really enjoy it.
I thought that would be the only book that I would ever write. You know, it's very autobiographical. And... it was the only book I felt impelled to write. I thought it would be my only book. But people that I knew and respected seemed to like it, and I decided to continue. Meanwhile, I'd been fired from my job, so I had nothing else to do but write. So I did write, and been writing ever since. Been writing about 40 years, you know, and I don't know what I would have done without it.
But your first actual published book was Lee, isn't that right?
That's right, yes.
Which I just love that book. I think for people like us who kind of feel out of step with the modern world, that it's just, explicates so many feelings that I've had in dealing with the modern world, that he's just so shamelessly curmudgeonly and just hates everybody and everything. And it's great. I think it's a real catharsis to read for me.
I wanted to describe perfectly alienated human being, someone who is estranged 100%, and someone who is utterly alone. You know, somebody said that the man who is most alone is the man who is the strongest. You know, I don't know if that's true, but I do think that, you know, a person who has fallen back on his own resources and depends on nothing outside of himself, you know, there's something to be said for that kind of autonomy. Now, after I wrote that book, I read Steppenwolf by Hermann Hesse.
Oh, one of my favorites.
Mine too. And the first two-thirds of that book, you know, absolutely resonated with me, because here is a man that's cut off from polite society and knows how to make the most of that. I think he ruined the book in the last third of it when he begins finally to break out of his alienation, which I thought was a mistake. But... there are people like that. I think some of Dostoevsky's writings, the underground man, you know, people cannot deal with society, not because there's something wrong with them, not because society is dangerous, but because it's boring, you know, not because they're afraid of it, but because it's a waste of time. I mean, someone like I myself, you know, I mean, I've got to the point where I no longer desire literary recognition, because I don't know hardly anybody whose recognition I desire. I mean, do I desire recognition from the kind of people that watch primetime television and read Stephen King? No, I don't need their mandate. You know, don't want it. I would consider it almost an insult to be liked by people like that. So as you get older, you become more and more self-sufficient. You also become more individualized, I think, when you become older. You know, you develop your strengths and you try to deal with your weaknesses. So you become, you know, odder. You know, you become more, have more sharp edges than when you're middle-aged or young. So finally, I think all old people always end up pretty much alone. And the trick is to not mind. Don't object to that. I'm very lucky in my case to have the luckiest marriage of anybody I've ever known. So I'm never really alone. I mean, I could live on a desert island with my wife and be entirely happy. I could live in a world that had no other human beings in it, as long as I had my wife.
That's always been something that surprised me a little bit in your work, is because I always get the sense when I'm reading any of your books that there's a strong autobiographical element, yet when I try to reconcile that with what I know about your actual life, it's not anything like these characters you write about.
Yeah. Well, I use my actual life as a sort of a platform, and then I simply depart from that to employ imagination, to imagine not things that I actually did or things that I could do, but things that I might like to have done or things that I wish somebody had done. Like Lee, you know, I would never be as brutal as he is, but I wouldn't mind having been that way if I'd had the nerve to do it. You know? So, my books are very autobiographical, but not factual, not factually autobiographical.
More maybe psychologically autobiographical.
Yeah, spiritually autobiographical, yeah.
That's good.
So, Tito, one thing that strikes me about your work, aside from your love of education, especially liberal arts and history and philosophy, but also science and appreciation for science and really all the great achievements of the Western mind, there's a strong love of classical music that comes up again and again in your work. Can you talk a bit about your love of classical music, when that began, who are your favorite composers, and so forth?
Yeah, I was very slow to come to classical music, but I had the advantage of knowing my wife's father. And my wife's father was also a novelist, and he's the most fascinating person I've ever known. He was a real hero in my mind. He was a factory worker who lived all his life on a very small income and yet managed to write 20 novels on weekends and during sick leave while educating himself to the nth degree. He knew more about music than anybody I've known.
You know, what
he
was
could
his
listen
name?
To a simple Christopher Clark, Chris Clark. Christopher Clark. He only published two novels in his lifetime, and neither of them were successful. I have to say that I don't consider him a great novelist, you know, but I like his books, and most of all, I like that he did them. He was able to do them under the circumstances in which he was living. But he was brilliant. He knew everything about history, and he could listen to a symphony, and he could tell you within a minute who was conducting, who the conductor was. He could tell one piece of music from another simply by the conductor. He knew all about the composers, but the history surrounding the symphony. He was just absolutely dazzlingly brilliant about music and about history and about economics. He had such a hard life, though, that as he became older, he really became disenchanted with the modern world, and he could not get his books published, and he finally gave up writing them. He wrote a long book on economics and tried to get it published. He tried to explain to me his theory about economics, but I could not understand it. And to be truthful about it, I'm not absolutely sure that the book made much sense, you know. But he was struggling. He was trying and never gave up. Had a heroic life. Most of all, he gave birth to my wife, who was, you know, since nobody has been like her since the time of Penelope or since the time of Andromache or the Greek maidens, you know, or since the time of Eloise, you know, I mean, just She's given me the best marriage that I could have. We married when we were 18 years old. And we just recently celebrated our 60th wedding anniversary. Nobody said the wedding, that our marriage would last. Well, it's lasted 60 years. But it's still longer than the marriages of any of those persons that criticize us for getting married. So that gives me a triumphal feeling that I picked the right woman and jumped on that chance. I hadn't been away from home for 24 hours before I bumped into the woman that was perfect for me. I congratulate myself for having recognized it. It would have been so easy to pass it up, you know. And everybody told me I was too young to get married. My parents hated the idea, but thank goodness I knew what I wanted. I took it. It saved my life.
So tell us about some of your favorite composers.
Well, I was driving today. I was driving from one place to another here in Alabama, and I turned on my machine. I happened to have Tristan and Isolde on, and it had Kristen Flagstad was singing the soprano. And any question about who my favorite composer was just vanished at that moment. You know, my favorite composer by all measures is Richard Wagner. Mm-hmm. I just don't think there's ever been anything else like that. I mean, he's the man that sends me into a trance. You know, I can hear him and I can see mountainsides, forests, beautiful women, and I mean, it just puts me in another world. So he has to be my favorite. But he's not the only one I like. I like Mahler a great deal, Gustav Mahler. I like some of Shostakovich, particularly his second cello concerto. I really like that. I like Ravel and Debussy a great deal. In recent days, I've begun to like Dvorak a great deal. I think I had underestimated him earlier. Really like Dvorak, and there are many of them that I like.
That's wonderful. In terms of your philosophical worldview, what thinkers have been most influential?
Well, the one thinker by all odds most influential to me has been Nietzsche, Friedrich Nietzsche. I mean, Kant said that he had seen something, had done something that woke him from his dogmatic slumbers. Well, Nietzsche woke me from my dogmatic slumbers. You know, I simply did not realize what the possibilities are. You know, I mean, it was like I was looking up at the sky, you know. There's nothing that cannot be done. You know, if a man progresses far enough, he can supersede himself, surpass himself. You know, there don't have to be any limits. Anything that limits man should be crushed and destroyed. That's what really attracted me to Nietzsche. His wide open view of his and his bravery, you know, to overlook conventions, and overlook whatever, you know, his current environment. And also his ability to write prose. I don't read German well enough to know whether his German prose is as good as I think it is, but I've been told he's one of the greatest prose writers in German. So I just have an enormous admiration for him. And other thinkers, there are other thinkers too, of course. Most of the thinkers that I'm accustomed to were actually fiction writers. But among philosophers, I don't know. I do greatly admire, I don't know whether you call him a philosopher, but I think that Spengler is one of my favorite thinkers. And his idea of the influence of culture, how a person is born into a culture and can never get rid of it. That cultures live and die like an organism do. I've also read Toynbee, and I thought he was superb, but I do believe that Spengler's more sophisticated. Of course, I do like the old Greeks, Socrates, who seems to be in Plato. I think Plato's the man who really invented metaphysics. His idea of the categories, the idea, you know, his analogy of the cave and all of that, that certainly resonates with me. So I do read philosophy and love it. I have to say that I bend more toward the arts, you know, toward literature and music than toward pure reason. So philosophy is a secondary interest for me.
Well, you mentioned Nietzsche. I could definitely see that influence. But what about Schopenhauer?
No, I don't. I prefer Nietzsche. You know, I mean, Schopenhauer believed that, you know, that the will to exist, the will to survive, preempted everything else. I don't think so. I think Nietzsche was right when he said it's the will to power that preempts everything. I mean, people commit suicide, so the will to survive cannot be preeminent. But people will also kill themselves striving, you know. People will gladly kill themselves for the sake of triumph, you know, to triumph over life. You know, that is a more sophisticated notion, it seems to me. I think the will to power is what makes the world go around, and thank God for it.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's interesting, though, because a lot of your characters, they have this will to power, but except in one or two of your books, they usually don't actually have all that much. They're sort of kings of their own immediate surroundings. But, well, like in Sinashura, you know, the character, he has sort of a contempt for the masses around him, but he never really attains any actual power or anything in the course of the story. I thought Schopenhauer.
Well, you have to understand what power means, you know. I mean, it doesn't mean becoming president of the United States. It doesn't mean becoming a billionaire. It means being self-mastery. I mean, who had more power than Wagner, you know? I mean, it takes power to be, it takes power, you know, to discover a new theory, a new doctrine. That's power. Nietzsche considered Wagner to be a perfect example of the will to power. Not because he was in politics or finance. So, you know, I think the will to power, if understood properly, you know, is one man's greatest asset. Without it, man is just an animal, you know, a worm. So that's why I admire Nietzsche so much. And Schopenhauer not so much. Although
I can see now.
I think, yeah. I mean, Schopenhauer, I think, I like some things about him. You know, he was another alienated man who went his own way and he was arrogant as hell. I like that. I love arrogant people. And like Sinusura, you know, my boy, my hero in Sinusura is very arrogant. Lee's arrogant. I think some people are arrogant for the wrong reasons, of course. Some people are arrogant for the right reasons. I mean, some person's aware of his own, just aware of his own superiority, has deserved to be arrogant. Which is why, you know, ordinary people despise them so much. If you're not despised by the masses, there must be something wrong with you.
What was your relationship like with Christianity and religion growing up?
Oh, no, I grew up in a religious, you know, a Protestant family, went to church and accepted the whole story, you know, until I got to be about 15 or 16. I had a roommate in private school who was way ahead of me, and he had shucked off religion already. And I was appalled at first, but after I talked to him for a while, he converted me. And so I now despise the religions, all of them, you know, particularly Christianity. I mean, Christianity is a woman's religion. Christianity is a humanitarian, altruistic religion about turning your other cheek and all of that. So I feel about Christianity the way Nietzsche did, you know, that it weakens human beings. No, Christianity is not for men. Of course, I don't believe in the mythology, you know, I don't believe in the fairy tales that go along with it. But there's some kinds of Christianity that are, you know, certain forms of traditional Catholicism, I think, are philosophically defensible. But it's not for me. I'm secular. Although I do believe in transcendent values. I do believe in supernal values, although not religious ones. I'm more akin to the Platonic belief in absolutes. You know, I believe, for example, I believe that beauty is something that actually exists. And even if human beings did not exist, there was somewhere still there would be a category called beauty. And I believe that artists are simply those rare people that are sometimes able to grab hold of it a little bit, bring it down to earth. I mean, that's why some of the worst people are some of the greatest artists, you know. I mean, the artist is not something you can achieve because you're a good person. It's something you can achieve because you're organized molecularly in a certain way that you can apprehend it. You know, like a person with a telescope can see the stars. You know, some people can see things that most people cannot see. And that's got nothing to do with the virtue, you know. So most people think that a good artist is a good person. No, not necessarily. So I look upon art, and you know, like Plato did, justice. It really is a thing called justice. So we don't quite know what it is. Certainly it is not equality, but I think there are these categories that exist outside of human beings. How do we know if something is beautiful or not? Beautiful in comparison with what? You know, I mean, if you see two girls standing side by side and one is beautiful and the other is not, how do you know which one is beautiful? There must be a measure. There must be a yardstick somewhere. Anyway, that's my feelings about religion.
Yeah, I would say your books are probably among the most amoral fiction I've read. That's a compliment, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah, there's not, you know, there's not any moralizing going on in those books. Quite the opposite.
Nietzsche said that a good war, a good solid war, can justify any cause. Doesn't matter how bad the cause is, as long as the war is good. You know, I believe that. You know, as a Confederate Southerner, I believe that. I believe that we lost the war, of course. But what a good war it was. You know, we almost won. We were outnumbered toward the end, 3-1, 4-1, 5-1. We killed a lot more of them than they killed of us. You know, that's victory. That's a victory.
Although, actually, I would say, you know, that in that case, though, I mean, the cause was actually a good one. I mean, it's easy to romanticize these things after the fact, but I think that's true in this case.
Absolutely. Yes, I think it was a great cause. And I think it's not over. You know, who knows? Someday the South may get its revenge upon the North. I do hope so.
Yeah, it's almost a shame that technology has progressed to the point where war is so destructive to humanity and humankind, where, you know, it's something that after World War II, the entire world is more or less, you know, shied away from the ultimate end that war can lead to.
For now.
That's true. But have you noticed the success of guerrilla warfare? I mean, you know, technology can be defeated. I mean, how the hell did we lose Vietnam? I think people who know how to engage in stealth warfare, urban warfare, subversion, the use of the internet, can do all sorts of things short, you know, of having to use nuclear weapons. I don't think warfare is going to come to an end just because weapons are more destructive. I think it'll just shift modem. We'll go into a different modality. The wars of the future will be guerrilla wars. There'll be information wars. There'll be wars of subversion. You know, that's how I think that's the way it will happen. You know, I don't think we're going to have any more World War IIs. No one can afford that. I mean, I don't think even North Korea wants to have a war. So, no, I think that wars will just simply change shape.
That facet of human nature is something that's not going to change.
Well, some people think that if there weren't war, humans would decay. Yeah. War is one of the things that keep human beings alive. We've had presidents that believe that Theodore Roosevelt thought that a nation didn't go to war once in a while was decadent.
The only thing that
revivifies people. You don't know you're fully alive until you've been in a war, you know. And you have to live close to death to be fully alive. You know, the man who is not aware of death standing behind his back is not alive. You know, you need that shadow behind you at all times. It makes life worth living. There's a beautiful line in the Iliad where Achilles says that the gods envy man because the gods can't die. Man can die. And being able to die gives value to things. You know, what's the value of a love affair if you could have 10 million of them? It's, you know, it's the limits. It's the limits that make life worthwhile. And a short life often is very much more vivid than a long life. People live too long, in my opinion. I think that most people should, you know, I think most people cease to grow when they get to be about 18, 19 years old. They congeal, their brains congeal over. And so, mentally speaking, they're already dead. And some people never quit growing and developing. So they're still alive. And those people, I think, should stay alive. But, you know, I don't think longevity has any value whatsoever. And what matters is life. What matters is thought. What matters is experience. What matters is art. That's all that matters. Not prosperity, you know, not good health. I mean, some of our great people had very poor health. Health is not of any value unless it's being used for something. You know, modern bourgeois consumer society believes that if you can sit on your ass in good health and watch a lot of television, you're doing real well. Most of those people sitting on their ass watching television might as well be shoveled into the ground as far as their value is worth. You know, it's not comfort that matters. You know, it's apprehension that matters, comprehension, knowing, thinking, seeking, loving. People who don't have that might as well be dead. The rest of us would be better off if they were dead.
So it's more a matter of the intensity of one's life and the length of it.
Yes. Oh, well, of course. If you look back over your own life, I would wager anything that you won't even be able to remember 99% of it. I mean, 1 hour is like any other hour, but there are those moments, those divine moments that you cherish. That's what makes life worthwhile. If you could take all of your great moments and put them end to end, they might occupy 2 weeks. You might have 2 weeks of great moments, and then you'd be ready to die, because the rest is just waste. The rest is just fill. The rest is just gray space. And most people's whole lives are nothing but gray space. You know, when you see people worrying about the price of gasoline, or, you know, or clipping coupons, you know, or taking their blood pressure every 2 hours, they're wasting your time. And what matters are those vivid moments. You know, it's like digging through a pile of manure to find a few nuggets of gold. That's all that matters.
Well, you mentioned, you know, your interest in the sort of the Platonic ideals and how it relates to beauty earlier. And I'm thinking that's kind of a good philosophical segue into Sinishura, because that's sort of what it seems like that's what you're doing in that novel, is it's almost like the Platonic ideal of love between these two characters.
That's right. Precisely. You know, I wanted to delineate a love that is almost more than human. Love that is unlimited, you know, a love that is dangerous, you know, a love that can't last very long. You know, it burns too brightly to last very long. And I particularly wanted that for the woman. You know, this is a woman who at some point decided she knew what she wanted, decided there was only one thing worth striving for, just one thing. And she was going to devote everything to, she was going to make herself into a work of art. She wanted to be as beautiful as possible. She wanted to make herself a love goddess. And she wanted to save it up for the one man whom she wasn't sure she would ever find, the one man that she could give it to. And she wanted a few climatic moments with this man that would make her life worth living. And once she's had that, she's not afraid to die. She's done her job. You know, she's like a lightning bug that has to flash its light a few times and then is ready to die. That's what I wanted. And I wanted also to portray two exceptional people, two people that, you know, live at a higher level than most people. And I'm not sure I've succeeded in that. I mean, the boy is brilliant, you know, but I don't know about him. I'm not sure I've succeeded with him. But the girl, I may have succeeded in part with the girl. I mean, you know, my wife doesn't like the girl. The girl is arrogant, and the girl loves herself too much. But I don't mind that. I think people should love themselves if they deserve it. You know, I mean, psychiatrists say you cannot love anybody if you don't love yourself. Well, this girl loves herself intensely, and she can love somebody else also very intensely. So her vanity, I worship. I think beautiful girls should be vain. The more vain they are, the more I like them. Any girl that spends her, you know, they owe it to us. I mean, would you take a beautiful painting and hide it in the closet? You know, if they're beautiful, we need to look at that. We need to see it all the time.
Yeah, the vanity. I had a really wonderful conversation with my friend Hugh McDonald, and I think it's available as a podcast here on Countercurrents, where we talked about vanity. And he said that he wanted to defend vanity. It's not a vice. He wanted to defend it as a propensity to beautify yourself, to make yourself as beautiful as possible. What's wrong with that?
It's
a worship of beauty and an attempt to beautify the self.
Absolutely. It is a parallel to beautifying the mind. You know, a perfect person would be able to do both. You know, as someone said, you know, Nietzsche liked people, you know, that looked like Apollo, they could speak Greek. You know, that would be, what a wonderful ambition. You know, we'd never be able to achieve it. You know, I wish I looked like Apollo, you know, but that's not in the cards. But I have no criticism like of weightlifters, you know, women who spend their money on makeup. I mean, they beautify the earth. You know, I wish everybody looked like Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know. And why not? What's wrong with that? I don't see anything wrong with that.
Well, it goes back to the Christian versus the classical value system. The classical value system really wouldn't look down on a desire to make oneself beautiful, whereas the Christian value system looks at those people and thinks, well, those people, they need to dial it back and tone it down a bit because they make the ugly people feel bad about themselves. And so
they should feel bad about themselves.
Yeah, and so vanity becomes a vice. Vanity becomes a vice. The desire to beautify oneself becomes a vice. Yeah.
Yeah,
it becomes
the
sin of pride.
For you. Yeah, I think people should be proud if they deserve it, if they've earned it. I mean, I despise this Christian belief in modesty, self-effacement. You know, I think people should expand themselves and go as far as they can go. Now, I mean, I just cannot abide this womanly attitude, this female approach of Christianity. You know, that we should, you know, they should be meek. Why should people be meek? We should be self-effacing. We should be slapped in the cheek and turn the other cheek. We should bid the little children to come unto us. That kind of stuff makes me want to vomit. You know, to hell with modesty and meekness. You know, I believe in self-realizing yourself. I believe in exemplifying yourself, going as far as you can go, doing all you can do. And then when the time comes, lie down and die and not worry about it.
Right.
You know, I just cannot abide. I'm almost 80 years old now, and I have no fear of death whatsoever, you know. I mean, I say my life has been about, you know, 75 or 80% of what I wanted it to be. I married what everybody told me I should not. I got fired from half a dozen jobs that everybody told me I was destined, you know, for destitution. And I did everything everybody said don't do. And I'm very pleased with what I did, you know. And I know that, you know, my books will never be successful, but it didn't bother me. I did what I wanted to do. It's what I had to do. I did it. I'm glad. And that's all that matters to me.
There is a sense in which modesty is an aspect of a life of self-improvement, in this sense that you can say that when you look at people who are better than yourself, you feel the difference. You feel your own inadequacy. But then the real issue is whether you're just told, well, that's all well and good, and you can just stay there and be satisfied with that. You're being virtuous by being modest. Or if you treat that as an occasion to improve yourself, you're aware of your inadequacies, you're aware of your limits, and then you want to go beyond them. That strikes me as important. Really?
No, I don't see it that way. I mean, I'm aware of people that are much superior to me. That doesn't make me feel inadequate. I mean, I measure a person by how well they did according to what they could do. I mean, I can't do what Wagner did, and he's achieved a hell of a lot more than I'll ever achieve, but he had greater capability than I have, you know. So I'm glad that he did what he did. It doesn't intimidate me. I just congratulate him. I'm not awed by it. My question is, have I done as well as I could do? Or have I done nearly as well as I could do? If I have, then I don't feel humiliated by superior people.
So you believe that you are your own measure in that sense? Your potential is the measure that you look to?
Absolutely. What else could it be? I mean, you know, if an imbecile has learned how, you know, to play poker, I consider him a great man.
Right. Is there a role, though, in your worldview, then, for looking to others as examples, exemplary people?
Oh, yes.
How does that fit in?
Well, you know, you envy them, you imitate them, and you measure yourself by them, and you try to aspire to their achievements. I mean, we all do that, I think. The people that I adore, you know, are people that I would like to think he might come up to me someday and pat me on the back and say, you're doing pretty well, buddy. That's what I would like, you know. And so I aspire to what they have been able to achieve. I measure myself that way. And, of course, many times I realize, you know, how inadequate I am. But that, I'm not bothered by that. I mean, I just realized, you know, if I'm comparing myself to a genius, a real genius, I don't feel humbled by the fact that I'm not a genius. You know, I'm glad the other fellow was a genius. I wish there were more of them.
Who are some of your heroes, some of the people in your life who have been exemplary and that you have tried to imitate in some aspect?
Well, there haven't been very many people that I greatly admire. One of the persons I admire greatly that's going to make you want to vomit is Adolf Hitler. I think he's an astonishing human being. I think he's a genius. I think his ability to take control of all of Europe. You know, this waif, this man, he was wandering around the slums of Vienna. That's the will to power beyond all belief. Forget about what he did. Forget about whether what he did was evil or not. Just forget about that part of it altogether and look at the achievement itself by itself. I think an astonishing human being. And I think if you wanted to measure yourself by what he was able to do, there'd be nothing wrong with that. So I think he's an extremely admirable person. I think when you want to measure somebody, you have to put aside whether or not you think his achievements were positive or negative. Like Nietzsche said, you know, a good war justifies any cause. I believe that it's the struggle that matters, not the results. It's the exertion that matters, the accomplishment. It's going beyond yourself that matters. It doesn't matter if 10,000 people have to die. I mean, after all, they would, if they could do what you could do, they would have you in the ground too. You know, I mean, life is competitive. So I don't begrudge people, you know, for creating wreckage all around them. I admire Alexander the Great enormously. So I measure people by capacity, not whether what they do is likable, but whether what they do is sweet and compassionate or not. I really don't care about that. I just care about ability to take things in hand and do enormous things. That's what I admire. So who else do I admire? Well, Alexander, I admire, and most of all, I admire the great thinkers and the great composers and the great writers. You know, I mean, these are the best people in the world. These are the people that make life worth living. If it wasn't for William Faulkner, and if it wasn't for Dostoevsky, and if it wasn't for people like that, I don't see the point of going on living. Those are my heroes, the creative people, artists most of all. I think the artist is the rarest, the most unusual kind of person. A writer, you know, a great writer is a freak because he has an extra module on his brain. You know, it's as if his brain had a little knob on it that other people don't have that gives him extra sensory perception. You know, when I read a great writer like Homer, you know, or well, like some of the Greeks, or if I read a great historian like Thucydides, you know, these people are artists, too. Historians are also artists. The great ones are. And it's as if they have an extra facility that ordinary people just do not have. So those are even more than politicians, even more than conquerors and generals. These people that can break through the intellectual shell that restricts us, get out of the cocoon, you know, that inhibits us, and think of something absolutely new. I mean, assuming that there is anything that can be absolutely new, that can break out and make a new pathway. Those are people who make life worthwhile. If it wasn't for those people, what would we be doing now? We would be eating raw meat still, you know, we would be living in caves. So those are the people that matter. And those are the only people that really matter. Those are the indispensable people. Ordinary people are not indispensable. And we have far too many of them.
So let's go back to Sinashura and give our listeners a sense of what the novel's about and why they should buy it. Sinashura is one of 14 novels, by my count, that have now been published by you, and that includes the 4 volumes of the Williams House series. So how would you describe it just in a nutshell? I realize, of course, you wrote the book, and I don't want you to repeat the book, but just give us a sort of little nutshell sketch of what it's about and why you felt you needed to write this. I guess what impelled you to write this is a good question.
It's a love story. It's a love story between two extraordinary people. And it describes a love affair unlike most other love affairs. That's the nutshell right there.
Well, one thing that strikes me about the book is that it's not really something that you read wondering what's going to happen next, because
you
actually have little asides in the book, which, you know, they're kind of amusing, where you basically say, like, you know, that these two are destined to get together. So it's not the kind of book that you're reading, like, wondering, oh, you know, are they or aren't they? You know, so it's almost like they're being, you know, propelled towards each other.
My greatest weakness as a writer is plot. You know, I don't plot books. You know, I don't care about plot. I don't care what happens. I only care why it happens. You know, I only care about what goes on in people's heads. I don't care what they do with their hands. I've been criticized for that. My books are not organic. You know, the plots don't evolve naturally, seamlessly. I just don't do that. I want to describe reality in a touching and immediate way, and personality. I want to talk about people's personalities, what goes on in their minds, what motivates. I'm interested in the human mind. I'm not interested in what happens. I mean, my books are predictable, I don't care whether they're predictable. I mean, I don't even like plot. You know, there's hardly ever a book that I can read that I don't already know after the first page what's going to happen. I can see, all right, yeah, I know what's going to happen. These two people are going to fall in love. Oh, I see what's going to happen. You know, he's going to murder his mother. Oh, yeah, it's pretty clear what's going to happen in this. I mean, and even if you can't predict, I mean, what difference does it make? I'm not interested in what a murderer does. I'm interested in why he does it. And I'm interested in what goes on in the interstices of his brain. You know, that's what fascinates me. And I'm only interested in some brains, not most brains. I'm interested in exceptional people with exceptional brains and what goes on in the chemical ferment of those brains. That's really all I care about.
When I was reading Sinisura, I thought it was unfolding very naturally. And then near the end, the main character, the female main character, suddenly dies. Mm-hmm. And it seemed abrupt to me. And when I reread it, I saw that it was indeed, there was some foreshadowing of it that I had just not computed as I was reading through it. And it forced me to think, to rethink what was going on, because I was expecting the story to, how to put it, I was expecting a longer tale with a beginning, a middle, and an end, and maybe a happy ending or whatever. And then I realized I'm not going to get that. And so I went back through it, and I suddenly noticed something else came into the foreground, which was especially the boys' ruminations about the intensity of particular moments and how this particular moment was perfect and how life was justified by it. And, you know, life is not justified by the happy ending because we all die. You know, there's no happy ending if you go out long enough, right? And so you've got to seek the justification of your existence in the process itself. And I as I reread it, a couple of times I came to appreciate that that's really what was going on here. It was a novel where since the happy ending is cut off, everything really depends upon how these people savored the moments of their lives. And
that's right, sure.
Yeah.
You know, someday the earth will disappear. Someday humanity will come to an end.
Mm-hmm.
So the happy ending, any possibility of a happy ending has already been forbidden. There can never be a happy ending. So, you know, if human life comes to an end and ceases, as indeed it will someday, what matters? What is left? What matters? I mean, does a great love affair, does even that matter after all? Nobody will remember it when nobody is alive to remember it. You know, what if a person writes a novel and nobody ever reads it? Does that mean the writer wasted his time? No, I don't think so. I think a great love affair is valuable in and of itself, even though it comes to an end, and although nobody ever knows about it. I mean, after all, that's what's going to happen to all love affairs.
Mm-hmm.
After the planet's been destroyed, nobody's going to remember Romeo and Juliet. Nobody's going to remember Tristan and Isolde. So do those things have value? I think they do. I mean, the value is subjective, of course, not scientific. But what else is there? What in the world? What else is there? What else is there except moments of glory and beauty?
Right.
And all such moments are brief, unnecessarily brief.
One thing I would like to do is request something from you. I would like this story to continue. I would like there to be another novel where we see the young man who survives this relationship somehow overcome what's happened and get on with his life. I think that that would be a very interesting story in itself. There's a huge.
I second that.
Yeah, there's a huge challenge that's been posed to him. And can he get on with life? Can he have a full life after suddenly losing this girl who was so perfect for him?
Well, you know, I haven't decided myself whether he's going to have a life or not. I mean, I had originally expected him to commit suicide after her death.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm still not sure, but maybe he should. But you know, Greg, I'm almost 80 years old now, and I've written 20 novels, and I'm getting goddamn tired. You know, I mean, this last novel was an ordeal for me. I mean, I usually write a novel in 4 or 5 months, but this thing took 2 years, and it was very difficult. Not just because I'm getting old, and not just because I'm losing energy, but because it's a novel about young people. And I had to dig back and remember, what is it like to be young, you know? And that's hard. And so I'm not sure I'm going to be doing any more writing. You know, I've gotten some god-awful lazy, and I want to enjoy my marriage and my books, my books and my dogs and my boat. You know, I don't know. I'm not sure. Nobody reads my books anyway, you know? So, I mean, not that I expect them to, but... I write for myself, and if I don't need that satisfaction anymore, why should I write? And so I'm not. I could write another book about a hero, but I have to think about that. What would I do with him? He would never be happy. Of course, he couldn't be happy even if he had never met the girl. Even if he had never met the girl, he would have been a lonely, alienated person. But all of my characters that way anyway. So I could have written a novel about what he accomplished with the. What's left of his life. But I think I've kind of already done that, you know, and my characters are alienated people, and I've described what they've done. So I'm not sure he would do anything different than what Lee Peffley does in my other books.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I'm probably finished writing. I've still got half dozen books haven't been published, and you mentioned you might be willing to publish some of them.
Well, we're going to publish as many of them as you give us. So that's a promise. A couple more of them in the works right now. The next one will be called Though We Be Dead, Yet Our Day Will Come.
Yeah.
And then after that, The Philatelist. And there are a few more in the queue that we'll get under contract and bring out in 2018 and 2019. I'd like to have them all out relatively soon
too.
Just because I enjoy reading them. I enjoy working on them.
Yeah.
That's very flattering. Very flattering. To have somebody like you like my books, that makes it all worthwhile. What were you with your IQ of 136? I love it.
I wish I were smarter. Anyway, but no, seriously, I wish you were better at languages and stuff like that and math. But anyway, I very much enjoy your work. I think it's tremendously satisfying. It's just beautiful as language. It's just beautiful and sumptuous to read. Sometimes I'll lose track of what's going on just because I'm enjoying the ride. And in a way, that's sort of the message, right? In a way, that's sort of the message. Enjoy the ride because there are no happy endings. And you've got to savor the moment. And I do savor every moment of reading your work. There's just so much humor and wryness and surprisingly beautiful descriptions in your work.
Oh, well,
So
I like to hear that. That's what I like to hear. That's why I like Thomas Wolfe so much. You know, I mean, I've kind of outgrown him now, and he doesn't appeal to me the way he did when I was young. But his use of language is unsurpassed. I mean, what beautiful language he could use. They called him Mr. Adjective.
Right.
His use of sumptuous adjectives. I try to write with a cadence, you know, rhythmically.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm surprised that most modern writers don't try to do that. You know, you pick up a modern piece of chick lit, and it's like a couple of girls talking on the telephone, you know. I mean, there's no effort to make the prose special in any way. It's just plain, down at the heel, street language. So I do try to write well.
Yeah, the last piece of popular literature that I tried to read was the Twilight novels, because I thought the movies were interestingly subversive of feminism. So I thought, well, I'll just read ahead and see what's to come.
Yeah.
It was the worst writing I'd ever read. It was so sodden and tasteless and it was just like vast amounts of wet cardboard, you know. It was dreadfully pedestrian prose and very poorly edited. Astonishing that a mainstream publisher that has infinite amounts of money, certainly after selling these books, it had infinite amounts of money to pay somebody to do some decent editing, and yet, nope, none of that. It just was bundled off to the press, you know, with all of its premenstrual soddenness and flabbiness intact. It was just dreadful. Yeah.
You know, there was a time when a publishing house had one foot in commerce and one foot in literature. But they picked up that foot and taken it out of literature, and now both feet are solidly placed just in commerce.
Mm-hmm.
They want bestsellers. And they say that they have to have bestsellers to finance publishing good stuff. But where is it? Good books are few and far between. It's not at all like when Faulkner and Hemingway and Steinbeck were being published. It's a different world. You know, I mean, now even our best writers, like Cormac McCarthy, for example, is a pretty good writer. But he's not at the level with Faulkner, for example. So,
he has a very sparse.
What's that?
Oh, I just said his style is very spare. It's not descriptive not like you were describing with Wolfe, with adjectives and so forth.
Yeah, well, spare writing too can be very good, of course. Spare writing has to be practiced and has to be worked at. But the modern writers don't work at their prose at all. They just spit it out. You know, you get the impression you can write one of those books in a week. You know, and they don't rehearse their set. I mean, they don't care. They don't care. I'm not sure that they don't even know what style is. I don't think they could read Wolfe, for example, and recognize the style, that it has style.
Right.
And first of all, today, you know, a book has to be extremely assimilable, easily to assimilate. If it's at all difficult, if it has, you know, three and four syllable words in it, it won't be published. And if the sentence is more than 15 words long, that won't be published either. It has to be extremely simple, like an advertisement or like television prose. The modern reader is not set up to understand complex sentences, compound sentences. They can't understand it. It's beyond them. I mean, the American mind is shrunken. It's just appalling, you know, and the future is very dim, unless, like I said before, unless we have some sort of cultural revolution in this country. Maybe we will. Things get bad enough, sometimes you can have a revolution.
Well, Tito, this has been a real pleasure. We've been going for about an hour, and I would like to just wrap up here. Are there some final thoughts you'd like to leave us with, perhaps on literature? I hope there are young writers out there who are listening to this and maybe wondering what they can do. Do you have any advice for young writers?
Well, you're not going to want to hear this, but I would advise young writers not to write unless they want to make money. If you want to write as a career to become famous and rich and thin and have a mansion and you want to write pulp, go ahead. You have a chance to succeed. You might make it big. But if you're serious about literature and you want to write something perceptive and original, don't do it. You're wasting your time. You know, Spengler told us that a long time ago. So we're at that stage in history where art no longer has any significance. Today you must be an engineer. You know, you must go into software or finance. This country is long past the age of culture.
You were saying earlier, though, that the satisfaction is actually creating the work itself.
That's right.
So wouldn't that be the reason for somebody who really wanted to produce great literature?
If there are people out there that can satisfy themselves with that, I mean, that's hard. You know, that's asking a lot. Somehow it works for me, but to ask somebody else to take on that, you know, is maybe not a good thing to do. You know, it's like asking somebody to, you know, to run out in front of the army and be the first person to charge forward. You know, I mean, it's suicidal almost. So that's why I wouldn't recommend anybody do it. But besides, it doesn't matter what a person recommends. Anybody, if a certain kind of person is going to do it anyway, even knowing in advance what your fate will be. It's like those Confederate soldiers who knew they were going to do it, who were charging ahead anyway. That's the kind of writer you have to be today if you want to write serious prose. You have to know that you're not going to be rewarded. You might even be held in contempt for it. But do it anyway. And you don't have to encourage people to do it. The right kind of person will do it anyway because they have to do it. So I don't encourage people to write. I just leave them alone. And if somebody comes along who's willing to take on that burden and enjoy it, willing, able to enjoy it, then by all means, I will admire them. But I would never nudge them forward to do it. That would be cruel.
Well, yeah, I guess you could. That's a good analogy. You mentioned the Civil War. Writing of that sort could maybe be like your personal Pickett's charge. You know, you might not win the war, but it'll be a beautiful defeat.
Sure. Yeah, right. I don't even consider it a defeat.
Yeah, that's true. That's a bad. I shouldn't express it in those terms. It's more, I guess, more the spirit of Pickett's charge than.
Well, it's unfortunate we don't have a longer period of time to continue this conversation. Now we have to keep things to an hour. Because I'd love to ask you about your take on, you know, film and plays and, you know, other media of art and of storytelling.
Well, I adore film. I really like a good film. And we still do have some once in a while. And I think, you know, that in the 50s we had many fine films. And, you know, acting has changed a great deal. So being an old man, I have some trouble acclimating myself to new styles of acting. You know, today, realism is the only thing that seems to matter. And actors today are very naturalistic. Whereas actors in my youth, you know, were more expressionistic. You know, the actors that I used to like Marlon Brando or James Dean, you know, today would be considered histrionic, I suppose. Whereas today's actors, like Al Pacino or like, you know, other people, I don't even remember their names, they don't seem to be acting at all. And that's the way they want to be. They don't want to seem to be acting. It's like peeping in through the wall, seeing somebody behave naturally. Well, that's one way to do it. I don't criticize that. It's one way to do it. But I simply prefer the older movies more, you know. And the theater, I don't ever go to the theater anymore. I go to opera. Love opera. And where I live, there's not much of that going on. Atlanta has a good opera house. I sometimes see very fine operas there. But what I especially appreciate is the way they have now broadcasting Met operas on the movie screens in nearby Tuscaloosa. Yeah, and I like that even better than being at the opera because you can get close-up views of the singers. I saw Parsifal at a movie theater here in Tuscaloosa, brilliant, you know, and you could almost reach out and touch Placido Domingo on the face, you know, and the sound is excellent. So I love film, I love opera. I don't love theater quite so much, you know. I can never convince myself that you know, theater people are restricted to a stage, and you know, the sound is not so good when they're trying to yell to be heard. And plays, you know, are so constrictive, so they're limited to a few square yards of space. You can't get close-ups. You can't get close-ups of a man's expression in a theater. So I prefer film to theater. Although I've seen some good plays. I saw Long Day's Journey Into Night on Broadway when I was younger. And I just haven't been to theater in years and years and years.
Well, Tito, I think this is a good place to stop then, and we'll just leave them wanting more. So let's do another of these conversations soon. And like I said, we've got plenty other Tito Perdue novels coming out. So every time we bring a new one out, we'll treat that as an excuse to bring you back to discuss it and art and ideas in general.
Well, Greg, I must tell you how much I appreciate your willingness to publish my stuff. I mean, I spent 35 years trying to find publishers, and I would find a publisher, and I would get published, and the books, of course, would not sell. They would lose money, of course, and that would be the end of that. So, but I, you know, people like you who are willing to take the loss, I mean, my God, what a martyr you are, and very grateful to you. So, and the fact that you're willing to publish my unpublished books, I never expected that to happen. So, you know, I just want to thank you for all of that, Greg.
Well, thank you for creating these novels. That's the true great work. I'm just trying to make sure that we can share them more broadly with the rest of the world, because I know you feel like there's no audience out there. Or
I don't think that.
Yeah, I think you feel like you've come too soon or too late for an audience. But I think we're reaching an audience. So we're going to find your audience. We're going to find the people who will carry your work forward in some way, carry your ideas forward. And I hope that you're going to be an inspiration to a new generation of novelists. And all the best American literature since the beginning of the 20th century has been coming out of the South. And I see no signs of that changing in the 21st.
Well, and you say I don't have an audience, but if I have you three gentlemen, I'll settle for that.
Well, thank you very much, and we will definitely be back again on Countercurrents Radio.
Great. Thank you, Greg.